From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, Moscow slaps a full embargo against US and EU food imports in response to sanctions imposed on Russia by the US and its European allies.
Some of the big imports that Russia is noted for, Russia importing a huge amount of chicken from the US, that's due to be stopped according to this, and a huge amount of vegetables and meat from the EU as well.
Also today, why an aspirin a day could stop us not only from developing cancer, but could also cure people of the disease. And the closing arguments are heard at the murder trial of Blade Runner Oscar Pistorius.
The accused fired 4 shots with a powerful handgun through this locked toilet door. 3 shots hit the deceased.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. There is no U.S. military solution in Iraq. That's the line the White House is sticking to on the rapid fall of northern Iraqi towns to Islamist militants. U.S. President Barack Obama has met with his national security team to weigh a series of options ranging from dropping humanitarian supplies to some 40,000 stranded religious minorities to airstrikes on the fighters from the ISIS group. Nina Maria Potts reports from Washington.
As many as 40,000 religious minorities in Iraq have been dying of heat and thirst on a mountaintop after death threats from ISIS militants who have taken control of several key towns in Iraqi Kurdistan. The White House will not say if the U.S. is in fact weighing options that include the possibility of airstrikes. White House spokesperson Josh Earnest said there was no U.S. military solution in Iraq, but he faced a grilling from reporters who challenged him on whether the U.S. would stand by and watch a genocide.
This is something that we are closely watching, and it is something that we're
watching. People might be slaughtered.
And what we're doing is we are actively supporting the Iraq security forces and Kurdish security forces.
And while ISIS militants inch closer to the Iraqi Kurdish capital of Erbil, Washington is under mounting pressure to act.
It's time for closing arguments in the high-profile murder trial of South African Paralympian Oscar Pistorius. The state prosecutor has asked the judge to find the athlete guilty of premeditated murder, saying he is a liar who's tailored his evidence to suit himself. Mr. Pistorius' defense maintains the athlete accidentally shot and killed his girlfriend, Reva Steenkamp, in February last year. Gary Alfonso reports from Johannesburg.
Day one of closing arguments was mostly taken up by State Prosecutor Gerry Nell, outlining inconsistencies in Pistorius' evidence. He said the athlete's version was simply not plausible because too many facts could not be answered, like witnesses who heard a woman screaming, the victim having food in her stomach, and lights being on at the time shots rang out. But late in the day, defense attorney Barry Roux gave insights into his main points of argument, saying the state failed to answer material facts. Roux said the factual timeline of events could only support Pistorius's version, and he again made reference to police incompetence at the scene.
The European Union says Russia's ban on food products from the US and EU is politically motivated. Moscow has issued a full embargo against Western agricultural imports, including fruit, vegetables, meat, fish, and dairy products, but says the action was due to health standards. The move comes in response to coordinated sanctions by the EU and US against Russian businesses and individuals over Moscow's annexation of Crimea and failure to disarm pro-Russian militants in eastern Ukraine. Russia also says it's considering banning European and American airlines from flying over its airspace. A European Commission spokesman said the EU will be looking into possible action.
The announcement is clearly politically motivated. The Commission will assess the measures in question as soon as we have more information as to their full content and extent.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has flown into Afghanistan to mediate a major dispute over June's contested elections. The two candidates, Abdullah Abdullah and Ashraf Ghani, both claim victory in the presidential election. Daniel Wrenches has more.
Despite the bitter dispute, the two candidates have agreed to an audit process to establish the winner of June's ballot, with the goal of forming a new compromise unity government by early September. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry's flown to Afghanistan for unscheduled talks with the two rivals, the apparent frontrunner Ashraf Ghani and Abdullah Abdullah. He's also discussing the process with outgoing President Hamid Karzai only days after the killing of a U.S. general by an Afghan soldier.
Russian authorities have allowed Edward Snowden to live in Russia for a further 3 years, after his year-long leave to stay in Russia expired at the end of July. Mr. Snowden fled the U.S. after leaking classified information regarding National Security Agency surveillance. Jake Rashbass reports from Moscow.
Edward Snowden's lawyer, Anatoly Kucherena, stressed in a press conference that Mr. Snowden no longer has asylum status but has rather been granted temporary residency. With this new status, Mr. Snowden will be able to travel abroad for periods of up to 3 months at a time. Mr. Snowden will be able to apply for Russian citizenship 5 years after the moment he first entered the Russian Federation. Russia's decision to grant asylum to Mr. Snowden last summer strained ties between Russia and the US.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports.
It has presented the choice to President Putin as to whether he is going to try to resolve the issues in eastern Ukraine through diplomacy and peaceful means, recognizing that Ukraine is a sovereign country and that it is up ultimately to the Ukrainian people to make decisions about their own lives, or alternatively continue on the course that he's on, in which case he's going to be hurting his economy and hurting his own people over the long term.
President Obama's reaction before Moscow confirmed a full embargo against US and EU agricultural goods, including fruit, vegetables, meat, fish and dairy products. Moscow is the second biggest importer of US poultry. The ban, valid for 1 year, comes in response to coordinated sanctions by the EU and US against the Kremlin's ongoing support for rebels in eastern Ukraine. Russia also says it's considering implementing a ban on American and European airlines from flying over its airspace. Tom Barton is FSN's Moscow correspondent.
Well, it's all about food, really, and that seems to be the weapon of choice for the Kremlin so far in terms of replying to these sanctions. The list is a long one and could get even longer. The main targets now that stand out are a ban on all food imports from the US and most likely the majority of those coming to Russia from the EU as well. And some of the big imports that Russia is noted for, Russia importing a huge amount of chicken from the US, that's due to be stopped, according to this, and a huge amount of vegetables and meat from the EU as well, that is also due to be stopped. Then we've got such varied things as Norwegian fish imports, Ukrainian dairy imports, which have already been stopped, Polish apples, which have already been stopped, and the list goes on and on. And it must be a huge task for those bureaucrats in the Russian government to try and decide what to put on the list and what to leave off it.
Right. So then, Tom, what's the impact going to be on the Russian retail market and, of course, the wider Russian economy?
Well, if you're a Russian, you've seen in the last year or so, especially, rising inflation that has the Russian finance ministry and central bank have already admitted has been rising too much. So the money in your pocket has been squeezed and you have been looking to try and keep those costs down. It does not look, because of this, that they will be going down. So Russians in supermarkets will have a harder time, it seems. It seems very unlikely that it'll go the other way, despite President Vladimir Putin's caution to those forming these measures that they should protect Russian consumers. It doesn't seem that that's going to be possible, at least not to any great degree. And we've also got all of those businesses that have sprung up in the last decade or so, or 15 years, that rely on imports, that bring food from all around the world in a globalized economy, that now will be hit very hard.
How much pain will the US and the EU feel after this decision?
Well, comparing the two, it's nearly the same across the board, that in terms of imports, Russia imports far more from these food stocks from the US and EU than they export to them. And in terms of trade volumes in money terms, we've got many times over going from, for example, the EU to Russia than the EU buys from Russia. So it seems that on the face of it, that the EU and the US will suffer a lot less damage overall than will Russia. So what is the objective of this? Well, it seems like a relatively cheap way for the Russian government to answer these sanctions. And it is hoped, I would imagine, by them, as many analysts have been saying, that the focused pressure that it will put on exporters, on agriculture and food industries in these countries may exert some political pressure on the politicians there. That does not seem like that it's immensely likely. And in the whole balance of these Western economies, these agricultural and food lobbies really don't have that much power when it comes to exports to Russia.
Right. So with this import ban in place, where will Russia turn to? Which international pantry are they going to reach into in order to fill the gap left inevitably by these sanctions?
Well, we've already heard talks in the Russian government about South America. That has been touted as a way to replenish the stocks. Whether that will be possible to a large degree, it certainly can't happen overnight, and it's certainly not possible to plug the gaps without any extra cost, especially as these economies know that Russia will be going to them to ask for deals. Fully aware of the fact that Russia is doing that because it's been shut out of, it's shut itself out of other import opportunities. So the chances for price hikes are there. There's Turkey as well, close by, potentially a significant exporter. But as I say, the ability to plug those holes without extra costs seems unlikely.
FSN's Moscow correspondent Tom Barton. This is FSN Reports.
The accused was a deceitful witness. The court should have no difficulty in rejecting his core version of events, not only as not reasonably possibly true, but in essence as being absolutely devoid of any truth.
Prosecutor Harry Nell with part of the closing arguments in the murder trial of South African Olympic athlete Oscar Pistorius. The Paralympic star is accused of intentionally killing his girlfriend Reva Steenkamp when he shot her through a bathroom door in 2013. Pistorius says the shooting was an accident and insists he mistook her for an intruder. Our correspondent in South Africa is Gary Alfonso, and he's been following the trial.
I think for most of the day, possibly around 90% of the day, Harry Nell definitely lived up to his reputation as the pit bull by primarily going after Oscar Pistorius' character and also his reliability under cross-examination, and in fact going as far as saying that even though he, Harry Nell, didn't call Oscar Pistorius a liar, the fact was that in the evidence that came out of Oscar Pistorius' evidence, he said it was clear that Oscar Pistorius was lying about several aspects. And one of them, and perhaps one of the three most compelling cases that Harry Nell put on the table today for the judge to consider in why the versions of Oscar Pistorius is in the state's eyes inconsistent, is primarily the stomach contents of Reva Steenkamp when she died. All witnesses conclusively said that there was no, or there's no real explanation as to why there was food in her tummy at the time of her death. It would illustrate that she would have had to have eaten by around about midnight, and therefore saying that if the couple went to bed at 10 p.m., it's completely implausible that Oscar Pistorius says they only woke up at 3 a.m. in the morning to close the doors, bring in the fans, and that's when he heard the noise in the bathroom. So saying there are major gaps in what Oscar Pistorius is telling the court and what the evidence and the scientific evidence is telling not only the witnesses that gave evidence, but also the state.
And this is all wrapped up in that phrase that Harry Nell was using, the snowball of lies, right?
Yes, absolutely. And it all revolves around a very small period of time in which he says Oscar Pistorius, from that time to today, has really changed his version to try and suit the outcome of the trial, so saying that Oscar Pistorius does not like to take responsibility, and after giving evidence and then under cross-examination, that snowball effect, meaning that Oscar Pistorius was not able to convince the court of the events that he said happened, so he was now shaping things to fit his defence.
So how has the defence for Pistorius responded? How have they portrayed the so-called Blade Runner?
Well, very interesting. Only in the last half hour of day one, in a time normally that the court would adjourn, but because the judge said they're going to be sitting there the whole weekend if they don't finish on day two, which is Friday, that Barry Roux, his defence attorney, really climbed into what he regarded as perhaps the 10 or 11 main points of what they would bring through, and he literally numbered them in a very powerful fashion, bringing forward the fact that the defense put it on the table for the judge to consider that the state was not really taking into consideration material facts in this case, saying that the timeline of events from the issues that even the state witnesses agreed on about when things happened, it would not have been plausible for Oscar Pistorius to shoot Reeva Steenkamp at 3:17 and at 3:19 scream for help if the state said that he was that it was the other way around, that the first sounds were the cricket bat noises and the second sounds were that of the gunshots. So very clearly the fact that Oscar Pistorius says he fired first and then put on lights and ran back and got the cricket bat and put on his prosthetic legs and then tried to break down the door. So the timeline, the defense was saying, was not gelling with what the state was saying. And then, but ultimately coming down to a man that was dismissed by the police as the chief investigator, a man called Hilton Buerta, which the defense said was a key witness and which the state did not offer as a witness to come and sit on the stand because it would obviously show that there was major police incompetence and tampering at the scene, and that's no doubt where Barry Roux is going to be taking this case tomorrow during his closing argument, the second part of his closing argument, that there was some serious destruction of evidence and also tampering and moving around of things, which gave the state in this case the issue to build a case against Pistorius that looked more than circumstantial. So he's saying that there was a deliberate attempt to try and make Oscar Pistorius look guilty by tampering with evidence.
It's been a while since we've discussed the Pistorius trial. I just wanted to for you to explain just briefly how this high-profile case is playing out in South African society, because it's unprecedented, the media interest and beyond, isn't it?
Well, I think if there were a productivity measure in South Africa, it would show that South Africans did almost no work today during the first day of these closing arguments, because people are obsessed by this case. They're sitting in pubs, in bars, looking at this case on television. They're following it in their cars. The social media uptake of what people are saying, small little bits of critical information being retweeted by people sitting in far-off places and saying, this is interesting, etc. It just really shows that this case has absolutely captured the imagination of South Africans. The social media is showing it, but also the fact that there is still a very, very big divide between the people that say they think he's guilty and those that think he is innocent and that it's just it was a horrible accident. So very strong divisions, but South Africans are truly obsessed with this case.
Gary Alfonso in South Africa. Now, taking an aspirin a day can reduce the risk of developing some forms of cancers. Researchers in Britain say a review of medical data suggests that the regular dose could limit the chance of dying from bowel and stomach cancers. However, scientists warn the drug can cause internal bleeding and shouldn't be taken without first seeking medical advice. Sarah Williams at Cancer Research UK told LBC the study has great potential.
Well, aspirin is certainly showing promise, and we're cautiously optimistic for the future. But as you mentioned, because some people will have side effects and they can be quite serious, and things like internal bleeding, it is too soon at the moment to start recommending that people take aspirin in order to prevent cancer. So we do need to do some more research before this can become a reality.
What we don't want, presumably, is for everyone to start you know, self-medicating? I mean, there must be lots that a doctor and a patient have to consider before taking aspirin long-term.
Exactly. There are a few people can't take aspirin. You might know that, but you might not. It can be to do with your likelihood of experiencing things like bleeding. It can also interfere with medications people are taking, including some cancer medications. So, you know, if people are thinking about taking aspirin long-term, then it's a really good idea to go and chat with your GP first.
Tell us how aspirin works on cancers then, and which cancers could it be beneficial for?
So at the moment, we think that particularly it's to do with cancers of your digestive system, so bowel cancer, stomach cancer, and esophageal cancer, so the food pipe. There may be other cancers, but they're the ones where there's the strongest evidence. And what's really exciting is it seems at the moment that aspirin doesn't just reduce your risk of developing these cancers. Even in people who already have cancer, it can actually help cure them.
We all want to see a cure for cancer, Sarah. Of course we do, much sooner rather than later. We know cancer's on the rise. Are you funding lots of work on the benefits of aspirin? Tell us what you're doing.
So Cancer Research UK definitely see the promise of aspirin, but because there are still these questions to answer around side effects and around things like the best dose and at what time of life you should take it and for how long. So Cancer Research UK are funding studies at the moment which will help us start to answer some of those questions.
And briefly, tell us about how long people might have to take an aspirin for. And it's not an overnight cure, is it? Presumably people have to take it for years before seeing any benefit.
So exactly. It's not just a question of popping one pill. It looks like at the moment, and this is one of those things we need more answers to, but like you might need to take it for at least 5 years, possibly 10. And it is a few years before you start seeing benefits in terms of reduced cancer risk. But those side effects I mentioned, there's a bigger risk of those the longer you take cancer for, and you can start seeing an increased risk of side effects as soon as you start taking aspirin. So it's going to be a question of sort of delicately balancing those two things off against each other so people can get the most benefit with the least risk.
Sarah Williams at Cancer Research UK talking to LBC's Lisa Aziz. And finally tonight, FSN Spotlight. Here's Simon Marks.
Today on FSN Spotlight, the quest to get women more involved at the highest level of Japanese politics. The country's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe says he'll reshuffle his government next month, and he says his principal aim is to redress a balance that has seen politics in the country almost a uniquely male preserve. He may be taking a leaf out of the British Prime Minister's book. Just a few weeks ago, David Cameron reshuffled his government in a bid to make it look, as the British newspapers put it, less male, less pale, and less stale. So what kind of odds is the Japanese leader up against? Dr. Kristen Surak is senior lecturer in Japanese politics at the University of London's School for Oriental and African Studies. She spoke to Emma Nelson and Marcus Hippie of the online radio station Monocle 24.
Well, women in the workplace are a presence, but they tend to be a presence more at the lower rungs of the employment ladder. So about 70% of the temporary workforce is female. What becomes a big problem is at the upper ends, where in Japan only about 2% of executive roles are filled by women. Now, this is an astounding number. If you compare it to Europe, where 50% of women in top roles at firms are female, or people at top firms are female, it's very, very low.
How would you describe the reasons behind it? Is it about attitudes? Is it about glass ceilings? Is it about just traditions and how women's role in society is perceived?
It's a mixture of things. One of the problems is that in Japan, there's not a glass ceiling, but what's known as a bamboo ceiling. A glass ceiling you can see through and have the, you know, have an idea that you'll be able to move on up, whereas in Japan, the ceiling is very low and very solid, like bamboo. So part of the reason is that women know that when they move into a top-level job, they will usually be hired not as in a career track, but in a non-career track. Once they get married and certainly after they get pregnant, there will often be, if they're at a large firm, a great amount of pressure to quit.
So indeed, I think it's the average return to work rate for women after having a baby in Japan is just 38%. So How important is Shinzo Abe's announcement that he wants to start putting women in his cabinet?
Well, he's not the first prime minister to try to do this. Junichiro Koizumi, who was premier, who took office in 2001, had 5 women in his cabinet, in fact. And it's become sort of a catchphrase that many prime ministers since him have taken up. In the case of Abe, it's part of a general sort of slogan that he's been using for the past couple of months about womanomics. Famously, the Goldman Sachs came out with a statement saying that if Japan were to get about 8 million women into the workforce, it would increase its GDP by about 15%. And Abe has, of course, taken notice of that.
How much agreement is there in Japanese society about this issue, about the need to include more women in public life and work life? Is this something that this announcement is going to boost Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's popularity?
Well, my sense is that because this is nothing new, 3 or 4 prime ministers before him have also said we need to increase the number of women in the workforce, that there's something of a sense that we've been there before. Increasing the number of women is part of an overall structural reform package that included, for example, encouraging companies to increase minimum wage. And we've seen a couple of companies do that, increase what they're paying workers by 1% to 2%, but it hasn't been very much. And my sense is that with womenomics, it's also coming down to what in Japan traditionally is a lot of encouragement from the government with statements saying, you know, we would like you to make efforts, for example, but without any real teeth to enforce, say, minimum quotas, for example, of, you know, women on executive boards of companies to really make that happen.
So let's assume then, Christine, finally, that Shinzo Abe does have his way and womanomics starts to make its way into his cabinet. Does he in fact have a talent pool that he can draw upon, or is the situation such that the bamboo ceiling has stopped women actually get that necessary experience, which means that they could function properly within a Japanese cabinet?
Well, Japanese companies, especially large ones, have traditionally hired employees straight out of university. And Japan has actually more women attending university than men. So the qualifications really are there. I think it comes down mainly to employment practices. And one thing I also haven't mentioned is that there's a great incentive for families to have only one breadwinner within the family. Once a spouse starts earning more than about £7,000 per year, they're taxed at a higher rate. It's more difficult to, they have to make larger contributions to the national pension, et cetera. So if a larger set of structural reforms, including things such as the tax and pension schemes, would really be necessary to encourage women and employers to employ more females.
That's Dr. Kristen Surak, Senior Lecturer in Japanese Politics at the University of London School for Oriental and African Studies, talking there to Emma Nelson and Marcus Hippie of the online radio station Monocle 24. You can find lots more international coverage on their website, monocle.com. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
And that's the Thursday edition of FSN Reports. If you'd like to tell us what you think of the show, email us reports@featurestory.com or follow us on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington alongside Rebecca Foster with The Bulletin. For everyone with FSN everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.